This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to present a case study on the Myuma Group, who are based near Camarwheel. It's a 15,000-word manuscript, so I'll mainly be just trying to sketch it out with some images.
You can give us 1,000.
Yeah, I'll give you 1,000. There's an introduction that covers the political context, which was pretty well covered by John yesterday with concepts of cyclic pendulum swings of government policies, neoliberalism, COAG trials, the Aboriginal problem, the recurring tensions in cyclic policy constructions between traditionalism and modernity, protection versus market liberalism, targeted service delivery versus mainstreaming, assimilation versus cultural pluralism. The case study is possibly an example, maybe getting close to one, of a seamless integration into mainstream economy, which was a term that John used yesterday. It is a Desert Knowledge CRC project, and it was part of a thing called Core Project 5, Desert Services That Work, Demand Responsible Approaches to Desert Settlements. As such, it sat between two aims of economic, researching economic development and researching demand responsive services in communities. And there were a set of goals set up for this project, not by myself, but by Mark Moran. And these are all addressed in my manuscript. I won't have time to go through them all, but I'll be mainly be talking about the first couple. And so it's the characteristics of the interplay between demand and supply of services. That's where the case study is set. It's on the Georgina River. I got involved in about 1999. The main roads wanted to upgrade the highway. The first thing was to build a bridge across the river because the existing bridge flooded every wet season. And there were two overlapping native title claims, and I was brought in as an independent expert to try to work out who are the bona fide traditional owners that the main roads should be engaging with. And it turned out to be the Injilaji group. And the bridge still couldn't be built because the female elders wouldn't let any piers be constructed because she said that the rainbow serpent was in the bed of the river. The bedrock was the rainbow serpent's bones. The piers would bring about environmental catastrophe. And we negotiated with her to put pad footings on top of the riverbed rather than drill through it, which she agreed with. And so eventually the bridge went ahead, and the group then levered up off native title. And it's probably something that should have been addressed in a bit more detail than it has in this conference, bringing to mind groups such as the Larrakia, who have really levered up their sort of economic situation from native title. And what the leader of the group did was to convince the main roads that they had to deal with his group. They had to employ them for cultural heritage survey. They had to provide a road camp for the group to occupy. This shows you the sort of the language group setting. This is where the camp is here. They've also got another quarry camp up here. It's part of a cultural block, what I call the Barclay cultural block. And this is to start talking about the idea. It's a case study of where the Dreamtime meets the market. There are important regional dreamings. The cultural links go right across to the Warramungu, and the Flying Fox dreaming comes right down through Lake Nash. Yesterday we heard about dingoes and red kangaroos at Erna Bella. Well, they're really important here too. Down here is Ali Kurung, which is the font of the dingo dreamings that come right up through here to the Gulf and are involved with young men's business. And down the Sandover Highway in the Aliwara country, we have Umbalubwich, where is the main red kangaroo dreaming that goes down through Heavy Tree Gap to Uluru, and which is the main driver of the older men's business. And these Arendik groups have moved in and occupied Alburulam in the Lake Nash in the 1920s, and the Injilaji, and have intermarried with the Injilaji group, so that this group is driven by these by the law block in this area, and forms the easterly extent of initiating groups left in Australia. We're also there, I should say, on the trunk trade route that was mentioned yesterday, the north-south trunk trade route, traditional trade route, bringing the ochre up from Parachilna and the pitchery from the Simpson Desert and the greenstone axes and so forth out of the Kalkadoon country. But this area was famous for ribbonstone. I'll come on to that in a minute. And this is part of the Injilaji's claims, and the camp is about 5 kilometres out of sleepy Camelwheel, which has only got a population of about 190 people. So this is a bit out of date, this drawing of the actual camp as it was set up, and this in the whole case study really reflects a lot of the ideas that Diane was talking about this morning. It's a harmonious site where relatedness is constructed for many, where people feel at home in the world for a time. There's a strong sense of personal and group morality and of camp morality, which mirrors some of the issues that Noel Pearson's talked about in his book Up From the Mission. It's a combination of employees and trainees. It is a very basic camp in the sense that they're all prefab donga buildings, but the rooms are like 3.5 metres by 3.5 metres with a wall-rattling air conditioner in them. But for many of the Aboriginal people who come here, it's the first time they've had a personal room. And there are associated then issues of personalisation of space that Diane alluded to this morning. All of the profits that have been made from enterprises have been recycled back into the infrastructure in the camp. There's no alcohol or drugs allowed in the camp, and there's a dining room in here, which has a menu, something like University House, where we had breakfast this morning, which is quite sumptuous. And an externally oriented lifestyle, and with outdoor recreational areas, and landscaped and hosed down every morning. This is the leader, this is the boss of the camp, Colin Saltney, who's the entrepreneur, the strong leader, the charismatic leader. He only went to lower secondary and became a ringer, and from being a ringer he became a head stockman. So his leadership skills come from being as a head stockman, and then he was elected on an ATSIC council, became ATSIC chair, got disillusioned with having to go and meet with Mr. Robinson in the casino and see the money going to Charleville and to Cape York, and said, how can I do something better for my people, which is his motivation for setting up this camp. That's the old bridge and the new bridge. There were 17,000 stone artefacts taken out from the bridge site, which tells you something about the stone production activity in the pre-contact and early contact era. And that's the senior elder, Mrs. Saltmere. There are a number of lithic archaeologists interested in the area, including Mark Moore, but the person who was there when I was starting was Tom Loy, who's unfortunately passed away. And Tom had a vision, a bioeducational vision, where he was going to have an international archaeology summer school there and bring people from all over the world. And that sparked Colinoff into thinking he needs to link with universities more. We'll come back to that point. There's a structure there to the to the way they've got business set up, but I haven't got time to go into that in detail. But there's a distribution of profits into some charitable projects as well, including seeding footballers into the Cowboys football team in And the after the bridge, the contracts started building up because all of the road back, the highway back to Mount Isa had to be done in segments. And so he got involved in this alliance contracting. If people don't know what that is, they could ask me a question, but it allowed them to make more and more profit in each contract. So this is a sort of a brief analysis of the commercial contracts. $20 million between 2001 and 2009, which is about $2.5 million a year, mainly on road works, building roads, repair and maintenance contracts on roads, fencing, quarry and camp construction. There are formal structures operating in the organisation, even though Colin keeps everything in his head and works on verbal agreements. The latest alliance contract that's being signed at the moment is with Joe Gutnick's firm. Diamond Joe Gutnick's got phosphate leases up there, which is going to set the Myuma Group up for the next 40 years with a lot of income. That's their cultural heritage, Duckalungi Aboriginal Corporation. There are additional monies coming in besides those contracts. I'll talk about the training scheme in a minute. This is the amount of money that goes back into the regional economy. As a consumer, Myuma pays out about $300,000 a year in food, $150,000 in fuel, and about $60,000 in electricity. The workforce comes from this Barkly cultural block largely, and you can see on the Aboriginal side, in this snapshot, there were 38 workers compared to 7 non-Aboriginal workers in the company. I wrote the marketing profile for the group in exchange for being able to use the information in presentations as I am today. People learn how to cook kangaroos and emus and turkeys in the camp. That's outside the dining hall. In trying to understand how this place works, I've coined the term Aboriginal service setting, which comes from an environmental psychology concept, the behavioural setting, which means a close fit between behaviour and the physical and temporal environment. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's an institution, but you could make certain comparisons with boarding schools or missions. It is very structured. Colin says it's based on a traditional multi-tribal camp, which is how he set it up. There's a very strong sense of order. There's a bell that goes at 6:30 for breakfast. Colin says he relies on building up a critical mass of peer group pressure amongst the Aboriginal trainees to be able to help persuade people about their moral order issues. There are Aboriginal mentors in the camp. There are camp resident elders. So there is an intergenerational structure operating. And the idea is that they get service providers to come to the camp. So they try to organise service delivery on Aboriginal terms and in an Aboriginal way. The training input involves 30 trainees at a time, and these trainees are often, you know, the worst of them come with VD, with unpaid fines, police fines, outstanding warrants, relationship problems, health problems, very low literacy or numeracy, and these are the sort of people who aren't just going to walk into Cairns or Mount Isa and present themselves to be sorted out, and that's what happens in this camp, but it's done on Aboriginal terms. And I've just been given a 3-minute warning here, so I'm going to have to speed up a bit. This is the catchment area. I actually run 3 workshops in the camp, one on cultural identity, which deals with relatedness of people to country and one another, whereby I have to actually do a workshop on the entire contact history of this group, of all these people in this area, and bring an awareness of how people come to be together in this camp and why there are differences in cultural identity and differences in the strengths of cultural identity. And then with some of the other elders there, we ran a workshop on religion, embedding people's identities firmly so that when they are in the workplace and these racist issues happen, they just don't fold straight away. And another workshop on family violence to try to help address the things that might undermine them in their own communities while they're employed. The trainees have contracts set up before they even come into the camp. Colin interviews them in their kitchens, in their home communities, and through these structures that he set up, industry structures, various places like Rio Tinto, Xstrata Mine, take a number of these trainees. And they're learning skills, of course, in things like concreting and welding and plant licences, backhoes, graders, bulldozers, computers, writing CVs, literacy, and doing community-based projects. And part of Colin's vision, the bicultural education, we've got money now from the Vice-Chancellor to set up an arid zone field station, and I take up botanists, ecologists, engineers, archaeologists who interact with the students, and we have projects going. This is our SpinFX project. There are environmental sensors in these humpies measuring the thermal performance of the SpinFX cladding. This guy's an Eastern Arendic elder in the camp. The beginning of Desert Knowledge, the core project five, was that the conceptualisation of it was that there seemed to be like a one-way directed service delivery by government departments into communities. Discrete communities didn't have the power of market demand that happens in the free market, and so the idea was to try to study a demand-driven service delivery approach. And in the Myuma situation, I modelled this as saying that it's very hard to attract services unless you're providing services in the market. If I'm to supply X in the market, I have to demand Y goods and Z services. However, the entities that supply Y and Z also want my supply of X. So once one's in the market, once one can insert oneself in the market and be providing services to other players in the market, it's only then that one can attract the types of services that the people want in that camp for their Aboriginal constituency. And this is why the camp works. And it's something that Karl Marx was onto. So the formula is attract a large-scale contract with government, host the Aboriginal labour on site in a social environment that's culturally appropriate, with employees reasonably comfortable, provide accessible training courses to the labour pool, added value for the employees so the labour force acquire ongoing diverse skill sets, identify consumer needs of the workforce, invite suppliers to visit the work camp, attract more enterprise and training contracts to achieve a stable continuity of employment. I'll just skip over that, but somebody mentioned adaptive systems before lunch. This is the branding. Colin's sister takes ochres from the baby dreaming site and paints with them. Colin's a stone napper. This is his sister's artwork, which is in National Galleries out of SpinFX grass. Cultural induction sessions. He's signing a contract with the National Park to do burning, so he's ultimately getting back into land management, which is one of his main aims. So there are a range of ways of relationships between Myuma's activity and Aboriginal law, including initiation ceremonies, visiting elders, cultural induction programs. Critical components of the success story. There's the entrepreneurial skills, leadership skills, but there are a lot of other things as well. The lobbying process in the industry and with government. And I write about trusted insiders and trusted outsiders, part of the local and regional economic market, pre-vocational training, but closing the gap, not just job readiness, but having jobs ready for the Aboriginal trainees. Okay. And a whole lot of other success factors there. So that's as much as I've got time for.
Okay, thank you. All right, questions or comments? Yes,
Just two questions.
You're in the dark up there.
Is the camp like a single men's camp? And how long do they stay on average out at camp?
Well, there are different populations in the camp. Some of the workers, there's probably about 60 workers and 30 trainees. It's probably in a proportion of about one female to four males. Some of the workers have been there ever since the camp was set up and are very, very stable. The course the trainees do is about 14 weeks, but Colin actually then reemploys a number of the trainees out of each training batch, and so some of them get to stay there longer as well and orbit back into the camp.
Yeah, anybody else? Questions?
Oh, hi, thanks, Paul. this Colin Saltmeyer seems a fairly incredible man. So is there a sort of a plan if something might happen to him? I mean, what would happen if something happened to him?
That's a good question. We've started talking to him about that. But, I mean, he does have a whole series of what I call lieutenants who are running different departments, and he's got his brothers who can help and his number of his sons involved as well. So, I mean, it's a hypothetical issue, but there are a lot of people there who probably take over. Well, whether it would run as well without him is an issue.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au. .au/audio